Judiciary Committee will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Members, the first order of business is approval of minutes for March 20th. Do I have a motion? Representative Hassan moves the minutes of March 20th. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye. 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 All opposed say no. Motion passes. Minutes of March 20th are approved. Members, we're moving the agenda around a little bit. The first one is going to be Representative Tabke, House File 2018, since he's here. Welcome to the committee, Representative Tabke. And we've got it's Paramutual Racing Commission licensing, reporting, etc. So does someone want to – what's the motion on this? The motion on this is to move it to the general register.
I'll move it, Mr. Chair.
I believe we need to go to state gov finance.
We got to go to state gov finance.
That's what I was told, but if you like general register better, then
Well, you know, we've done that before, and we thought we were doing people a favor, and then it turns out it wasn't a favor because we got to get pulled, so we'll go where you say that.
Yeah, let's go to state gov finance.
So Representative Herb moves that the matter that House File 2018 – do you have any amendments?
Yeah.
We'll deal with those later if we do. The motion is House File 2018 be re-referred to state government finance. Is it Ways and Means? Okay, so we got to go. So it goes to Ways and Means, and then they do their little Ways and Means magic, sprinkle a little pixie dust on it, and then it goes back down to state government finance. So that's going to be the motion from Representative Hurd. To your bill, Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is an agency bill for the Minnesota Racing Commission. The Minnesota Racing Commission takes care of and manages the racing activities at Canterbury Park in Shakopee and the Running Aces Racetrack in the North Metro as well. And so this is a bill that makes a series of technical changes, and it helps also with the fees. Currently in state statute does not allow the Minnesota Racing Commission to levy fees that are necessary for the operations as well as penalties. And so those are the different things that we are going to discuss today. And I have with me Mr. Tom DePasquale, who is in charge of the Minnesota Racing Commission, to explain the finer details of things, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Pasquale. Please introduce yourself to the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, Tom DePasquale, Executive Director of the Minnesota Racing Commission. Thank you for hearing the bill, staff and committee members. You have, I believe, three things in your packet that should assist in our discussion. One is a section-by-section summary of the bill. Second is we've boiled down the key elements in the bill. And third, you should have excerpts from the Racing Commissioner's International Classification Guidelines for Foreign Substances and Penalties, and I'll explain the relevance of those in a moment. But let me just step back and give you a little bit of background on the racing industry and why that is important to this bill. The racing industry is regulated in 38 different states. Each state has its own commission. And so while there's a lot of commonality between all the states, there is not necessarily uniformity in how racing is regulated. And as the industry has become more national in the last many years and even international, and as horses ship into the state from other states, we want to make sure they're subject to the same rules with respect to therapeutic medications, that the penalty framework is the same, and that the criteria for licensing is the same, so that they're not compromised by surprise in terms of what's allowed in each state. As racing has evolved, there's been a movement in the last 10 years to establish uniformity with respect to the criteria for licensing, with respect to the medications and prohibited substances, and also importantly with respect to the penalties, so that people who are in violation are treated roughly the same as they move from state to state. The model rules, some of which you have in your packet, have been adopted by Minnesota and just recently incorporated by reference in rule. So we have adopted the RCI penalty and medication guidelines. There are 30 therapeutic medications that are permitted in racing, and there are 1,000 or more prohibited substances, which if we detect at any level is a violation. And the penalty guidelines that I've provided to you classify the types of violations into class 1 through 5 or Class A through D, depending on the severity of the violation and the type of substance involved. So that brings me to the bill. And what this bill addresses is discrepancies between our enabling legislation, which dates back to 1984, as you may know, and the national uniform rules and the statutory authority we have to implement those rules. 99% of violations in racing are controlled therapeutic substances. They're minor overages. They're relatively slight violations, and those are handled routinely by the board of stewards or the racing officials at each track. They conduct informal hearings. Parties have all the due process rights at those hearings to be represented, to be put on notice of the violations, the right to be heard, etc. And our rules are very prescriptive in terms of those due process rights. In rare instances of a serious doping violation, which is described in your handout as a Class 1 Penalty A category violation, Minnesota's statutory authority falls short of our need to protect the integrity of racing, the betting public, and the safety and welfare of the horse. And the reason it falls short is that the commission does not have the authority to impose the sanctions prescribed by rule, and we've run into this in a recent case that was before an ALJ. And going back to 1984, the commission had authority to levy fines of up to $2,000 and 90 days before being referred to a contested case. Those thresholds have been raised recently, and what we propose in this bill is to have the commission have authority to impose penalties of up to 1 year and a $10,000 fine with at the stewards level, at the commission level, so that the people with the most knowledge of the industry, the most knowledge of the facts and circumstances surrounding any particular violation, are the ones that handle it at first blush, and then the licensee has all the rights of appeal and due process thereafter. Another thing the bill does is so what I've covered now are Sections 4 and Section 9 of the bill, and I want to say a word about Section 11, because as Representative Tapke said, that the bill also touches our authority to impose fines. And there is a section in the Administrative Procedure Act that limits the authority of agencies or commissions to impose a fine of greater than $700 without statutory authority. We do have statutory authority to level fines. It's in the statute in 240.22, and we're directed by the legislature to develop a schedule of fines. And we've done that, and some of those schedules are in your RCI penalty guidelines. What we want to make sure that there's no mistake about is that there's an express grant of statutory authority to impose fines in excess of $700, despite what the Administrative Procedure Act says, so as to prevent a frivolous argument before the commission or on appeal that the legislature did not give a specific authority to impose fines in excess of that amount. So that's a quick walkthrough of the enforcement and authority grants. There's other sections of the bill that you may want to talk about, and I'm happy to address any questions that you have specifically.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. DePasquale. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh. I was going through this, and it's a very hefty increase in fines. And going through the bill and going through the statutes, one question that is not answered is, where does this fine money go? Does it go to the general register? Does it go to the racing commission? I think we need to know where these funds are going so we have an idea what's going on.
Mr. Yes. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm glad you asked that question. Until a couple of years ago, the fines went to the General Revenue Fund, and the industry came to the legislature to seek an amendment to have those fine monies go for racehorse retirement, rehoming, and repurposing. So we have a special revenue fund where all the fine money, about $40,000 or $50,000 a year on a routine basis, gets into a special revenue fund. And part of what this bill does is give us specific grant authority to grant those monies. And in the last couple of years, we've granted about $80,000 to $100,000 for taking horses off the track. At Canterbury, I think there were about 100 last year that went off the track. They're let down on a farm, and then they're repurposed for hunter, dressage, trail animals, and we make sure we find a home for them. We do that program in conjunction with the Tracks and the Horse Persons Group, so Minnesota as a whole is being very conscious of where horses go after their racing careers are over.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lash, the testifier. That looks like a good program that's doing, but my concern is right now you just said you do about $100,000 a year, and with this bill, you can one person can a fine of $200,000. So I think we need to look at that, where the fine money goes.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of along those same lines, you know, we're on page 9 and page 10 about increasing the fines. I didn't really hear a reason why we need to do this. Can you speak to the reasoning and the need to actually increase them to the civil fines from up to $50,000 to $200,000? That's on page 9. And then they're actually raising on line 10.10 from $5,000 to $10,000 the threshold by which they can appeal.
Mr. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative, let me address both of those. With respect to the fines of $50,000 to $200,000, that has always been in rule since the beginning of racing in Minnesota. Those are fines only against Class A or B licensees, and that is the tracks themselves. And those fines are levied only for specific violations of rules and statute relating to their licensing criteria. So there's a very limited violation for which we can impose those fines, and we have never fined a racetrack in Minnesota. As a matter of fact, by rule, up until just a couple of years ago, we could only levy a fine against a racetrack with a contested case. That rule was changed a couple of years ago with the consent of the tracks. So that's not an increase in fines. Those are the same fines the tracks have been subject to since 1984. With respect to the $10,000, the reason for that is if you look at your Class A penalty grid and the RCI penalty guidelines, a Class 1A violation, first lifetime offense, subjects a person to a one-year suspension and a $10,000 fine with adjustments for aggravating or mitigating circumstances. We think that in those types of serious violations, the parties that should be dealing with that are at the racetrack. That would be the Board of Stewards, where the licensee is afforded a hearing within a couple of weeks. They can be represented by counsel. And rather than have those cases be subject to the potential for a contested case, which takes a year or longer to adjudicate, those cases should be administered quickly. What has happened in the past is we get a Class 1A violation, the party asks for a stay, we grant the stay so that they could have a hearing before an ALJ. Meanwhile, they're racing at the track, and other owners and trainers are saying, why is this person at the track when they have methamphetamine violation in a horse, and we haven't done anything about it? So the best way to handle that is in that first instance, the Board of Stewards hears the case, and then the party has a right to appeal to the commission or an ALJ.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so I understand the increase in the threshold for an appeal. That sounds reasonable. I'm still not clear, though, on line 9.29, because I believe you testified to say that these fines and these civil fines affected Class A and Class B, but in the additional language, it doesn't say that. It says $50,000 for Class C and up to $200,000 for Class A, B, or D. You didn't address C or D. Can you just, because this is new language, can you just explain that to us, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Representative, I misspoke. The up to $50,000 for a Class C license. Class C are occupational licensees. We license 5,000 or more occupational licensees each year. Violations that would be a third lifetime violation on your schedule of fines there, the maximum fine is $50,000. So you're right. 9.29 references the ceiling for fines on Class C licensees for a third doping violation, essentially, and we've never gotten there, and I'm not aware of anybody that has. And up to $200,000 is for Class A or B, which is the ownership and management of a track, respectively. And D is for county fair paramutual racing, which we don't have in Minnesota right now.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Just a final clarification. So what is the if we don't have that in Minnesota, what is the purpose of adding this to statute?
Mr. DePasquale.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the purpose of adding it in statute is to make clear that the legislature has granted the authority that we've had in rule since the beginning, and out of an abundance of care, we've chosen to put those fine schedules into the statute so as to avert what I referenced earlier. And if you'll bear with me just a minute, I'll give you the site in the Administrative Procedure Act. It's it's Minnesota Chapter 14. It's in the Minnesota Administrative Procedure Act. And that's the language I referred to earlier that says an agency can't impose a fine of more than $700 without legislative authority. But since this has always been in rule, everybody knows that this is the law. It's just that there had not been an expression clearly made by the legislature that we had that authority. If you look at the sentence right above that, or right below it, it does talk about the commission having the legislature granting the commission authority to impose fines according to a schedule. And this is just basically a reiteration of what that schedule is.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're essentially codifying rulemaking authority to try to make it clear. I guess I'm still not clear as to why you're including D if it doesn't even exist in Minnesota, but I appreciate the fact that you clarified your testimony because it wasn't clear on the onset that that's what you were doing, and I appreciate the clarification. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. DePasquale or the author? Seeing none, then. There is not an amendment, is that right? Or there is an amendment?
Correct. No, no amendment.
Okay. So then the motion. Representative Lassonde, you didn't have a question? Okay. The motion came from who again? Representative Herr. Representative Herr's motion is that House File 2018 be recommended be re referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is re-referred to Ways and Means. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
We're going to move to House File 1520, Representative Sandsteed. Welcome to the committee. And you do have an amendment.
I do have an amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, Representative Carlson, you want to move Representative Sandsteed's House File 1520?
Mr. Chair, so moved.
Mr. Representative Carlson moves 1520. And then your amendment is the A1 to give the bill in the shape that the author so desires. Representative Carlson also moves the A1 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is amended. To your bill as amended, Representative Sandsteed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just a little explanation of what the A1 amendment does. The bill that I'm going to talk about in just a moment was modeled after legislation passed in Wisconsin, which included some immunity language. This amendment clarifies language in our bill to meet the needs of the stakeholders that were involved in putting this together. It clarifies the public duty doctrine that states that this does not create a special duty. It also clarifies that an operator is not liable if a caller refuses or is unwilling to provide CPR. So to the bill itself, what my bill does is it aims to strengthen our state's EMS system by promoting telephone CPR training for 911 telecommunicators. Cardiac arrest is a medical emergency. What happens in the first minutes can literally mean the difference between life and death. Immediate bystander CPR can triple a victim's chance of survival. The general public expects that if they call 911 for a cardiac arrest emergency, the operator is going to be able to tell them how to start CPR while first responders are en route. What many of us, I think, are surprised to learn is this doesn't always happen, because 911 operators in Minnesota currently are not required to be trained to coach callers through providing CPR. House File 1520 would close this gap and save lives by asking our public safety answering points to do one of two things: either train their 911 telecommunicators in telephone CPR or transfer cardiac arrest calls to another answering point whose staff are trained in telephone CPR. With me today, I have a testifier, Lorna Schmidt. She's the Government Relations Director of the American Heart Association.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Schmidt. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, my name is Lorna Schmidt. I'm the Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. We are here to offer our strong support for telephone CPR and House File 1520 and would like to thank Representative Sandstead for her leadership on this issue and her numerous co-authors for their support. The goal of this legislation is simple: to save lives. Cardiac arrest is a medical emergency. Most cases occur outside of the hospital and result in a call to 911. Without quick action through CPR and defibrillation, death is almost certain. This makes the actions of bystanders critical, especially when you consider that EMS response times can exceed 10 minutes in many parts of the state. Bystander CPR can triple a cardiac arrest victim's chance of survival. In telephone CPR, CPR instructions provided over the phone by a 911 operator to a caller can increase bystander CPR. As Representative Sandstead indicated, this bill presents our public safety answering points, or PSAPs, with two options: to train their 911 telecommunicators in telephone CPR, or to transfer cardiac arrest calls to another PSAP who can provide CPR coaching for them. Coaching by 911 operators is not a new idea. It was decades ago when medical dispatch centers across the country started adopting protocols to talk callers through medical emergencies. Over the years, many PSAPs in Minnesota have done so, and in fact, both approaches outlined in this bill, providing instruction in-house and transferring calls, are already in place and working well in various parts of the state. This legislation would ensure that all PSAPs, at a minimum, can provide CPR instruction over the phone or quickly connect callers to someone who can. The public expects it, and these simple instructions can literally mean the difference between life and death. House File 1520 will save lives. We ask for your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Schmidt. Any questions for Ms. Schmidt? Representative Herr.
Chair Lesh, are there other testifiers? I could wait until
yes,
they're all
yes, we do
done.
Have one more. We have Ashley
Getty.
Getty. We have Ashley Getty up here. Excellent. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Getty. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ashley Getty, and I am from West St. Paul. My family personally experienced the benefits of telephone CPR, and I appreciate the opportunity to share a story with you today. Last October, the night before I was scheduled to give birth, my husband Andrew, that guy right there, went into cardiac arrest. Of course, I didn't know that's what it was at first. Andrew had otherwise been a healthy 28-year-old with no signs or symptoms of anything being wrong. But what I thought was snoring was actually him gasping for air, and he was unresponsive. I called 911. The operator identified that Andrew was in cardiac arrest and coached me through starting CPR until help arrived almost 10 minutes later. In those minutes, having someone tell me what to do, how to help my husband, was everything. At the hospital, I was told to prepare for the worst. I canceled my appointment to be induced so that I could stay by his bedside. With Andrew here today, you can guess how our story ended. Andrew miraculously made a full recovery after being diagnosed with Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, a rare condition in which an extra electrical pathway in the heart causes a rapid heartbeat. And just one day after his cardiac arrest, we became the proud parents of a healthy baby boy. Wow. We are so thankful for the doctors and first responders who helped us that day, including the 911 dispatcher who coached me to start CPR. The doctors told me Andrew wouldn't have survived without it. At the time, I didn't realize that not all 911 operators are trained to help people do CPR. Like most people, I assumed this was routine. Now I realize I'm lucky that the person who answered my call was able to give me that extra instruction. I don't know what I would have done without it, and no one should have to. Telephone CPR helped save my husband, and I hope you'll support this bill and make sure every caller like me can get the instructions they need to help a loved one in need. Thank you.
For your testimony, Ms. Getty. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lash. And maybe this could be for any one of the testifiers who might be able to answer this. So when I was a commissioner for the Police Civilian Review Board, I had the opportunity to tour 911 Center and to kind of spend some time with them. Not all 911 centers are actually, they operate the same, right? Like St. Paul's 911, the non-emergency number and the emergency numbers all roll into the exact same place. And then also they answer calls for some of the surrounding cities as well. And I guess I'm just curious as to what you're looking to do, does it matter how that 911 operation center is actually run? And then my second part of the question is liability, that if somebody can't actually see the physical situation and they're coaching you to do it, are there instances in which somebody could become injured because of the instructions and creating liability for the person who's giving the instructions on the phone to be able to do this without seeing the conditions?
Ms. Schmidt.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative, to the first question, this is written to be flexible and to give the answering points the option to decide how to best implement in with the structure that they're operating under. So I also have had the chance to shadow a number of PSAPs in the state, and what we're hearing is that, you know, for those who have staff who are trained, this would, in many ways, just codify their existing practice. For others, there is the ability to transfer those calls. And so in that way, the structure of the PSAP itself should not pose challenges to implementing this because of those essential opt-outs and options to transfer or train. To the second piece, you know, CPR is something that the instructions to coach someone through starting CPR, the questions, the evidence-based protocols that exist to help identify whether somebody is going into cardiac arrest are meant to address many of the questions and concerns that you raised. What we know is that it's better to start CPR on someone who may not need it than the alternative. If someone doesn't need CPR, we will kind of joke and say the best thing that happens is they maybe punch you in the face and they tell you that they don't need it. The chances of hurting somebody are actually relatively minor. And if the person survives, you know, if they have a broken rib or not, no one's complaining about that. So the protocols have been reviewed. They're backed by science. That's why we comment on the need for the evidence-based protocols, is to minimize those risks and to address those liabilities.
Thank you. Any other questions for any of the testifiers? Ripson O'Neill.
I just have a quick clarification question. In the amendment, it says a telephone CPR instruction is a general duty rather than a special duty. Can you just tell me the difference between a general and a special duty?
Ms. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, I would like to phone a friend on this, if I can. I'm not a lawyer. We have been working very closely with legal counsel and staff from a number of agencies, and so I think they would be better situated to define that difference for you than I would be.
Okay. Do you want to come on down? Representative Carlson may have Mr. Carlson may have an opinion on this. Were you going to speak to this, Mr. Carlson?
I can.
Okay. Morehouse Research, too, yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members, this relates to a common law doctrine that creates immunity for certain, basically, municipalities and municipal employees. It's known as the public duty doctrine. This is an extremely high-level overview, but in essence, when a municipality or other government entity takes on the responsibility of providing emergency services, fire protection, for example, they have certain levels of immunity in their conduct from being sued if they negligently provide that. The idea is that the duty that they are providing is a duty to the entire public, a quote, general duty. If instead they accept a specific duty to an individual or a very specific class of people, then that liability changes. For example, there have been cases related to reporting child abuse that's mandatory. Those children in those situations have been considered a special class, and therefore there is a special duty related to that. So if you negligently fail to report or fail to deal with a report of child abuse, that triggers the special duty. If you negligently go and put out a fire at somebody's house, that is a general duty. The language here is to clarify that the 911 CPR is not intended to create a special duty for a specific special class of people. It remains a general duty to all people who might call 911 to receive any sort of emergency services, including CPR.
Representative O'Neill, you're good. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering, Representative Sandstead, I don't see anyone here from, or maybe there are people in the audience that are 911 operators, and I'm just wondering what their stand on this legislation is, if you know.
So, Sandstead.
Thank you. I haven't spoken with any of them personally, so My impression through general discussion and stakeholder groups has been they're very supportive of this.
And Mr. Chair?
Driska.
Thank you. And Representative Sanstey, do you know what percentage of them are already trained to do this?
I don't, but Ms. Schmidt might.
All right.
Ms. Schmidt.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative, we have been working closely with a number of stakeholders that have close interactions with the answering points themselves to make sure that their feedback is taken into account. One of the handouts that I believe is in your packet is a summary of a survey that was done by the Emergency Communications Network to actually assess which centers are already doing this and which are not. The data that they found is that there are 27 of the 96 primary public safety answering points that are currently not trained in telephone CPR or transferring. So that is the gap that we are looking to address with this legislation.
All right, thank you.
Jennifer Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the author of the bill. I think it's important. We know that CPR is critical when someone has a cardiac arrest, that the first few moments are important. I'm just curious if this will be available statewide, and is there a language services that will be attached to this?
Representative Sanstey.
Our goal is to make this a statewide initiative. That's the purpose of the bill.
Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was also, is there language services available to others who don't speak English?
Ms. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that's something that we would be looking to address more as part of the implementation. So we'd be looking at the translation services that are already available that PSAPs are leveraging and trying to integrate this into that as well to make sure that any caller that is in need of CPR instruction is able to access it.
Thank you, Representative. Chair Johnson.
Chair Lash, members. Last October, the dispatcher from the ambulance service, I mean, in my county, they don't do that, but they transfer to, it's either North or Alina, and those the dispatchers do a very good job of doing this. In fact, they were able to talk my mother into doing CPR and my father, who unfortunately didn't make it. I just want to thank all the dispatchers. I've sat in the dispatch center and watched them trying to handle 8-10 phone calls at one time with multiple emergencies. They do a fantastic job. And I know the dispatchers want to do everything they can to help the people out there. And they are under a lot of stress, but they do the best they can. So thank you for this. I think it's a good idea.
Any other questions, Reps O'Neill?
Just a quick question about appropriation. We have a blank appropriation on section 3, page 3. Wondering if you have any sense as to the appropriation needed to implement.
Ms. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we did just find out that the fiscal note has been requested, so we're waiting on that information from the department. Based on the survey data that was collected, again, that we referenced before, based on how many centers need to be trained and what that looks like in terms of staff, along with what we know about free training materials that already exist and conversations that we are having with secondary answering points who may have the ability to accept those transferred calls, we are hoping that we can keep the fiscal note minimal. I don't have a specific number right now. What I could say is, you know, again, we're looking closely at what Wisconsin did with their legislation as well, and when they passed it, it was with an appropriation of $250,000.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Then Representative Carlson's motion is that House File 1520, as amended, be recommended be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is re-referred to Ways and Means. Thank you, Representative Sanstein, and to the testifiers. Chair Davids, welcome to Judiciary. Chair Davids, House File 2065. I will move that House File 2565 be recommended to be placed on the register, right?
Yes, 2565.
What did I say?
20.
Okay, 2065. Yeah, I don't think we're up to the 2500s yet, are we? Okay. Chair Johnson?
Chair Lesh, I heard a rumor yesterday that with the number of years that Chair Davis has been here, this is the first time in Judiciary.
Oh,
Mr. Chairman, I'm so sorry I forgot treats. I'll do better.
That is amazing.
So much for this bill. Sorry.
Did we kill the bill yet?
That's a major party foul.
Chair Johnson.
Yeah, you can thank your fellow chair for throwing you under the bus on that one, Chair David. So welcome to Judiciary. And you've got an author's amendment, the A2. Is that right? The chair will offer the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author desires? That is what you desire, isn't it?
Correct, sir.
Okay. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no. Motion passes. The A2 amendment is adopted. To your bill as amended, Chair Davidson.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. To the bill as amended, this bill changes the exemption for wages during garnishment and allows creditors to garnish earnings for 20 days longer than currently allowed under current law. Wage garnishments occurs after a creditor has obtained a judgment against the debtor. I have with me Mr. Ron Elwood, who has worked very hard on this issue to bring the proverbial peace in the valley, and I believe we've accomplished that at this point. But Mr. Chair Lesh, if I could turn it over to Mr. Elwood.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Lesh and members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I want to thank Representative Davids and Representative Carlson for authoring this bill. This is a non-controversial bill. We work with the Minnesota Association of Collectors and the Minnesota Creditors' Rights Association. The length of this bill and the amendment really belies its simplicity. It does really just two things. The first thing it does is protect a little more money from garnishment and allows people to have a little more each payday. And it does that because the current law, the amount that's protected is the greater of 25% of your disposable incomes or 40 times federal minimum wage. The change in this bill is that it says it's 40 times federal minimum wage or state minimum wage, whichever is higher, and that is the minimum wage that is currently in effect. The second thing it does is extend the garnishment period, as Chair David said, from 20 more days, from 70 to 90 days. The garnishments are renewable so that after the period is over, the creditor can go and for a fee of $15, which gets taxed onto the debtor's debt, can renew for another 70 days. So this just extends the period, hopefully reduces some of the amount that winds up getting tacked on. The amendment simply makes conforming changes to two other statutes that also involve garnishments, levies, sheriff's levy statute in Chapter 550 and the attorney summary judgment, summary execution statute in 551. So basically the same thing is repeated in three different chapters multiple times, which is the reason for it being so long. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Elwood. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had a chance to talk with Mr. Elwood about this and explain it to me. Don't let the size of the bill cause you any great heartburn. It's a lot of changing of just the numbers to update it, and as Mr. Elwood explained, going from the federal minimum to the allowing for the state minimum to allow for some folks to keep a little more money in their pocket. Took me a while to kind of get my head around this, but after having read through it, it's a good bill, and I hope you guys can support it.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, then Chair's motion is that House File 2065 as amended be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. You're to the General Register. Thank you, Chair Davids.
Thank you, Chair Lesh and members.
Representative Mueller. Representative Mueller moves that House File 2362 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Judiciary Finance Bill. So to your bill, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have an amendment.
Okay, yes, there's the DE1. Thank you. So Representative Mueller moves the DE1 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author so desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is amended in the form of the DE-1. It's not too often that you see a DE-1 with shorter language than the original bill, but that's probably good. Go ahead, Rep. Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So this bill is something that came from the Minnesota State Arts Board, and they're here and they're going to explain what happens. But essentially, when they have a grant process, when people are applying for grants, they have them open to the public during the when they're reviewing these grants, and that's a practice they've had. They had an audit, and that was a violation of current statute, but they want to be able to make sure that those are still open to the public. So that's what we're fixing with this language. And with the amendment, we were addressing Mr. Neumeister's concerns. This bill was heard over in the Senate, and there were some concerns about changing the language too much. So that's what we were trying to really do with our amendment, was really narrow the focus of this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, if I could turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. My name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and we have not been in judiciary before either. So I appreciate you taking some time to hear this bill. And we appreciate Representative Muller being the author of the bill. For those of you who do not know, the Minnesota State Arts Board, we're a state agency. We exist in the executive branch, and it is our job to support and promote the arts throughout the state of Minnesota. Primarily, we are a grant maker, and we make grants statewide, and we are the fiscal agent for 11, pardon me, regional arts councils that tailor their programs to their specific parts of the state. As Representative Muller mentioned, we had an audit this past year. Some of you may have seen it. It was released in February, and it was an audit of our statewide grants administration system. One of the things that we do is invite hundreds of citizen volunteers to come in and review the applications. It's not my staff or me who's deciding which projects are funded, but it's 500 to 600 volunteers each year who come in. They review the applications in an open public meeting, much like this. They rank them, and then they forward sets of recommendations. Again, like this committee, there are copies of materials in the room so that members of the public are welcome to follow along if they choose. And so what the Office of the Legislative Auditor found is that we are being more transparent than the Data Practices Act currently allows. And I'll just, if you will, allow me to read a few sentences from the report that highlights their recommendation. It says, the Arts Board process for rating applications offers a level of transparency that is important. Grant applications and others can observe how the board handles conflicts of interests and how it manages the panel process, and it can hear how panelists discuss each application. Public access to applications that the panel discusses may help people observing the process understand the discussion. Rather than requiring the board to make its process less transparent, we think the legislature should allow the board to make applications public concurrent with the panel review meeting to discuss the applications, except for data otherwise classified as not public. So that's what this bill attempts to do. And we hope that this committee will agree with the Office of the Legislative Auditor and allow us to maintain this level of transparency in our process.
Thank you, Ms. Jen. Chair Scott.
Well, I have to say, in the 11 years I've been here, I think this is a first where we've actually had more transparency than what the law allows for. I don't know if you've heard of that before or not, Chair Lesh, but this is a first for me. I do have some questions about the process, because art is a little bit different. In my mind, the grant process would be a little bit different than a research project or something where you can just fill the page with words. Do you actually get drafts of the art pieces themselves when you're doing this process?
Ms. Jens.
Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, no, we don't. We are not looking at, say, a rendering or a draft of a piece that would be created. What we're receiving is an application that describes what a project might be. And for us, a project can be anything from a student that might be applying for funding to go to a summer theater camp to a large arts organization applying for funds for a series of their activities. So the range of the activities that we in the Regional Arts Councils are funding is very, very broad. And we're not commissioning a piece, which I think is what you were probably suggesting.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Jens or for the author? Seeing none, then the motion on this is that be laid over for possible inclusion, and that is Representative Mueller's motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. I guess I didn't need to do that, but
I appreciate it, though. Thanks, everybody.
That's fine. You got, you're all on record for it now.
Love you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Jensen. Representative Mueller. Members, so we're done early again. Welcome back to post deadlines, where things are a little less stressful for everybody. And next week, the plan is still to not have any committee meetings until a week from today. We will meet until 12:30 on that day, on the 28th. We will have Representative Cantrell's bill on the U of M, Representative Mann's bill on physician-patient relationship non-compete agreement. It's pending referral for one of my bills, Representative Pryor's bill, and then Representative Noor's juvenile hearings is set up for that day. Next week, we will be submitting the omnibus judiciary finance bill that will be dropped, but keep in mind, members, that this is essentially the governor's request, and it will be changing a lot between now and when you know, we actually have the deadline, because there's a lot of moving pieces. So when you see it, just know that it's not a final answer. Any other questions before we adjourn, or any other business? Okay. Thank you. Committee is adjourned.